really wondering what the atmosphere was like. And, you know, I really feel like, you know, although those things that we see on Instagram are happening, they are not, that's not the norm. That's not, that, you know, generally people treat you with respect and decency. And me and Kamala were going all over Germany wearing Palestine flag t-shirts and kafiyas. It was a little cold for t-shirts when we were there. So it's, the kafiyah was the only indication of, you know, our politics and such. But that's a big no-no in Germany, they say. But certainly we got some possibly dirty looks. I wasn't even sure, but we didn't get any other problems. And, you know, that was true everywhere else we went, where they have the same kinds of restrictive speech laws and stuff. And I think, you know, while those things are happening to people, it's really, we get a really severely distorted idea of reality from our Instagram feed and Facebook and TikTok and everything else. You know, it's really distorted. And, you know, it really makes you gives, I mean, you know, another thing, I think we talked about this last time I talked to you, but I was in Texas and Georgia last winter and Arizona. And those are all places with a lot of Republicans, you know, and I did not see in any of those places, I did not see a single MAGA hat or, you know, other sort of indication of support for Trump anywhere, like in the physical world. You know, I only see that on the internet.
The bumper stickers are getting ragged. You know, you look at them and vote Trump, you know, 2016.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
What about, I mean, beyond the gigs that you guys did, and you did a lot of gigs, you did almost 20, but outside of your performances, did you see like amongst people in the streets and that like-minded people wearing kafiyas and, or people reacting with the opposite of dirty looks? I don't know if that would be, is that a clean look? I don't know. When they saw your kafiyah, like smiling and nodding or whatever.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that, but in Germany, not so much. Like in pretty much most other places I go, I get, like, especially if I'm in an airport, pretty much anywhere in the world, I'm getting a lot of positive feedback for wearing a Palestine flag t-shirt or wearing a kafiyah, but especially the Palestine flag t-shirts, I get a lot of positive reactions from people who are usually of some sort of visibly Arab or Muslim kind of background, but not always. It's often other white Westerners. But yeah, it's I get the positive reactions, like, overwhelmingly more than negative reactions. Like, actually, I never get negative reactions other than dirty looks, and that includes passing by the El Al area of the terminal in some airport I was at.
The Israeli National Airline.
Yeah, I got a real dirty look. it was like a very, very, very communicatively dirty look. It was like, if we were in Israel, I'd be beating you right now. Kind of dirty look, you know. Like, you know,
Were you tempted to go stand in line as if you were gonna get on that one of their flights? Just
tempted,
to punk.
Very tempted. Yeah, just tempted to just stand there.
You wrote an extensive essay, Europe 2026 Spring Tour Reflections, talking about your experiences. And when you're just talking about being in Texas, you include that actually in the essay. But when you talk about the sort of difference between the real world and the world that is mediated for us through our devices and other places too. And you said, and I'll quote you, that there are moments in the course of my travels where up close, real life, physical observations of reality in a particular place and time have seemed so valuable. And in reading that, I just had to think, can you imagine that sentence being read or heard by somebody 25 or 30 years ago? They would kind of look at you and go, what the hell? How else are you going to, you know, perceive reality? But for us today, it's all too clear that actual physical world seems to be disappearing, at least as our major source of information on what the world is and what our place in it is.
I mean, I think the main thing is, like, I mean, if you recall your youth, I think we're roughly the same kind of age, right? When we were young, the internet didn't really exist, but certainly mass media did exist. And, you know, the brainwashing was full on in the mass media in many, many different countries, very much including the U.S. But at least, you know, people might have some degree of awareness that they are being fed a line that the state or the powers that be or the corporations or whatever want them to be fed. You know, they're being propagandized. People can have that kind of awareness around mass media. Whereas when it comes to the internet and your feed on Instagram or Facebook or whatever, people are under the severely mistaken impression that what they're getting is some kind of like representative feed coming from people that they are somehow or another friends or associated with. And so they get the idea that they're getting some kind of realistic idea of what is happening in the places that are being that people are sending out videos about and texting about or whatever, but they're not. You know, it's not at all realistic. It's totally controlled, suppressed, algorithmically shaped, you know, information that we're getting. It's and I still don't think that most people even understand what the algorithms are, what an algorithm is. You know, especially people older than me, they really don't understand how they're being manipulated, but with those feeds and.
I can attest to that, David, because I know that I am older than you, and I don't have a clue how these things operate. But I always take it for granted that it is pernicious and it's aimed to do me wrong. You know what I mean? And I don't know if that is just because of the era that I grew up in. And I feel that my animosity, I would say, to technology and especially concentration of power that it represents, carries over into general areas of technological development. And there's no bigger elephant in that room right now than AI. You have adopted AI, and we've talked about this in the past, and you write about it in this essay as well at length. But in this sense, in writing your songs using AI prompting and stuff like that, and especially with iSuno, your collaborator, your avatar. But I'm thinking also about AI in the broader sense, and the AI and this invasion of these AI super factories, for lack of the right word, you know, these data centers sucking up the juices literally from the earth and spewing out these ominous monotone hums and driving people absolutely insane. Wondering, you know, about your perception of this new-ish threat to humanity, I guess.
I mean, I would say there are a number of different issues that are all very much related, but that in some ways need to be separated from each other in order to really have a useful discussion about the subject. Mm. Like, for example, the question of power use and water use by AI data centers. I think that really is a separate question from the overall sort of impact of this technology on society. And that itself is also a separate question from the morality and the ethics of AI, which is also a separate question from how we remunerate society or individuals or whatever for the commons that is being stolen from us by these corporations using AI and using every other form of technology. I mean, one of the fundamental things here, I think, is that there's in many ways, although many things about AI are new, in many ways, nothing is new about what's happening here. You know, we're talking about big corporations coming up with a massively influential new technology that is take the commons and marketing it back at us and making at a huge profit, but it's taking the cultural commons of the world and then selling it to us. And, you know, people who are like writers and musicians and, you know, other so-called content creators or whatever, you know, they take a particular offense to having all their work stolen and then marketed at us all, you know, because they generally feel like they have been getting the short end of the stick as far as all that goes for a very, very long time, like with the music industry and the TV industry and the film industry. You know, none of it is aimed at, you know, sort of allowing the actual people who are creating all this stuff to make a decent living. You know, the money doesn't go to us, it goes to other people. And that's very much still the case with AI. So, like, there's still the problem with AI. There is the massive problem of capitalism. Same problem with the film industry and the music industry. It doesn't change with AI. It just gets worse. It just gets much more concentrated, intense, like, because, you know, it's net because of the things you can do with it, you know, because it's an absolutely staggeringly amazing technology. And anybody that thinks otherwise obviously isn't using it. It's absolutely stunning. And anybody who has any kind of a skill set, you try finding an AI platform that makes use of your skill set and then see what you can do with it. And what coders say today, you know, people who do computer programming, you know, they are working at 5 to 20 times the speed that they used to work at, but producing just the same kind of quality work. And they're not coding themselves. They're telling the AI platforms what to code. That's the new way that this is working. You know, anybody who's still coding rather than telling an AI platform what to code, you know, is probably, you know, my age or older, and they just haven't. They're just not with it anymore. And as far as like trying out new technologies, you know, they're on their way out of professional relevancy very quickly. But if you are an artist, visual artist, if you're a filmmaker, or if you're a musician, and you use the platforms that are that are designed for us artists to use, I mean, what you'll find, I think, mostly pretty quickly, if you apply yourself, is that you can create art that is just as good as anything you've ever done, and you can do it at a ridiculously faster speed and at a ridiculously higher quality in terms of production values and for a ridiculously lower cost. So, you know, it is absolutely a completely disruptive technology. It will destroy so many industries almost completely. It's already doing that. It's already contributing to massive youth unemployment and all sorts of other problems. We can expect all that to get astronomically worse. But none of that is going to change if musicians stop using AI. I mean, or if I do, or, you know, it's just like you can kill your television all you want, but television is going to be here to stay. Television is and, you know, has and will continue to have a massive impact on people's minds, no matter how many hippies like us might, you know, not watch TV or smash their TV in public, or, you know, put on a bumper sticker on their car saying kill your TV or whatever. You know, it's TV isn't going to go away. It never was going to go away. Neither is radio, neither is the printing press, and neither is AI. We're just talking about technological progress, and for better or for worse, this is where technological progress is now got us to. It was all very well predicted for decades that we'd eventually get to this place, and here we are. You know, there's the question of, you know, is AI good at all? Is it good for us at all to have this kind of technology? And there's also the question of television, radio, the printing press, and a lot of other things. Are these things overall good or bad? I think, you know, is war always bad, or are there any positive applications to this concept? Is it the same thing? What is imperialist carpet bombing of a country the same as resisting imperialism by means of whatever force is at your disposal, whether it's machine guns or rocket launchers or, you know, whatever else? I mean, there are a lot of tools that we have in our world and humanity, you know, and tools are definitely not neutral. They have tendencies. They have certain kinds of impacts that they're likely to have, but whether they have a certain impact, and it often depends on how they're being used and who's using them and for what purpose. And it seems to me that as far as like AI goes, like, we are currently right now in a fight for the future of the planet. I mean, you know, Trump is trying really hard to start World War III, and Biden was trying pretty hard before him, but Trump's trying even harder. And that needs to be fought ideologically through propaganda, through communication, through art, the most powerful form of communication in existence. It needs to be, we need to be talking about this stuff. We need to be singing about it, writing about it, communicating about it in film, in every other possible way we can. And the idea of not using AI technology to do that communication is doesn't make any sense to me, because, you know, we got hearts and minds to win. This is a war for the soul of civilization. This is a war for the future of the world. And it's not like it just started with Trump. You know, it's been going on for a very long time. The future of humanity is at stake in terms of the climate and whether the United States continues to burn coal or not. That matters to all of us, or it should. And if we're going to try to reach the American people and the people of any other part of the world, we need to do that in whatever ways we possibly can, and that might be effective. And it is definitely a concern of mine that this technology that I'm using all the time is certainly causing lots of unemployment among session musicians, producers, engineers, and all these other kinds of people that I used to have a lot more to do with than I do now. And that's a terrible thing. But, you know, for me and for so many other people using the technology, and this is not to say that this doesn't make it all okay, but for me and so many other people using it, we couldn't afford to hire a choir in the first place. You know, I couldn't afford to hire an orchestra. I don't know a talented oud player. I don't know a rabat player. I have never even seen some of the instruments that I use on a daily basis in, you know, with Aituno. I could never form a band like the ones that I form all the time, involving some of the most amazing banjo players, oud players, rabat players, and, you know, hip hop artists. I mean, this is not something that would have been realistic for independent musicians ever. So we're talking about in terms of some of the complaints about AI music, and specifically, we're talking about the big time recording artists and labels, and they're the ones who have the most reason to be concerned, because it no longer costs $50,000 to make an album with totally professional quality production values and everything else. You can do it for a Suno account for $10 a month. Granted, you actually are a talented producer and, you know, and musician, and you know what you're doing, because otherwise you'll create AI slop. You know, these platforms don't work unless you actually know what you're doing. You know, that's why the internet is absolutely full of bad art, bad music, bad film, bad everything that's being made by people who don't know what they're doing. And they're playing with these amazing AI platforms, which, you know, you can be amazing at, I don't know, the old phrase was shining a turd. You know, if you shine a turd, it's still a turd, you know.
You know, you can be amazing. Yeah.
You polish a turd, you may be good you may have great technology, but if you don't know what to do with it, you're not going to be producing great music with it. You know, it bears mentioning, you know, I know you know this, but I write all the lyrics, you know, for all the stuff I do with AI, you know, and that's essential to why it's so good, you know, not to toot my own horn too hard here, but, you know, AI does not write good lyrics. And we can talk about why that is, and, you know, and of course it may change someday, but, you know, AI generally sucks at writing lyrics. Also, the AI mostly comes up with really bad music, you know. I mean, people should be aware, if they're listening to Aituno, that, you know, every song you hear, you're listening to the 60th or 70th or 80th or 90th version of the song. That was the one that worked. You know, I threw out all the other ones. And the reason why it's so good is because I know which ones don't work and I know which ones work. And the reason I know that is because I've been touring and performing for audiences for decades. And I know what kind of song is going to make someone cry. I know what kind of song is going to make somebody laugh. I know what kind of song is going to make somebody feel anger and want to go join a march, you know, because I'm a professional. I've been doing this a long time, you know, so I don't need to wonder anymore. You know, when I write a sad song, when I write a song that makes me cry, I know it's going to make other people cry. I don't need to wonder, you know. But when I hear Aituno play a song that I've written that I know is going to make people cry, if it has the right kind of music, then I know that I hear the first 50, 60, 70 versions. I know none of those are going to make people cry. And then when I hear the one that will, I know that's the one, you know. So that's my human professional contribution to the whole thing, which is why it works as well as it does.
Well,
people don't realize this.
Well, it's good to know that we still need humans after all. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with David Rovics, and David's a musician, as you can hear, a prolific songwriter, and he is just back from a tour of Europe, and he is just getting ready to come up to my neck of the woods here in British Columbia to do a number of gigs. I don't have it in front of me, David, but I do have the one in my city. That is Thursday, June 25th. You'll be traveling with Kamala, your accompanist. Mm-hmm. And you write in your essay about during the European tour, singing a lot of the Isuno songs, which, of course, as you mentioned, the complexity of them and everything else, it's Isuno kind of goes acoustic in a way. How was that?
Yeah.
How was that transition?
It's like so easy. And it's so, I mean, basically, because the kind of music I want to write is, people may say it sounds a lot like the stuff you do otherwise. You know, it sounds like stylistically very similar, which I think is a weird thing to say because I don't think it's true. But when the people who do say that, I understand what they're talking about, because the people who say that are the people who are really into hardcore punk, or they're into electronic dance music, or they're into something totally different from what I do. And so when they hear Isuno, they think, oh, that, you know, there's still banjos and mandolins in there. It sounds a lot like the kind of stuff you record, you know, on your own. And, you know, people, but there is truth to that too. And also because of that, the vast majority of songs that I write with Isuno are ready made for me to sing myself. It's just a matter of changing the key. You know, figuring out the chords is easy because she's using the same kinds of chords I normally use too. There's, you know, when it comes down to it, really, people may rather not admit this, especially the music industry, which is always trying to turn art into some kind of mysterious thing that only geniuses can produce. Mm. But the reality is there's only so many chord progressions out there, and they've all been used thousands, millions of times. There's only 12 notes in a standard scale in between the octaves, you know, and only 8 notes in a standard scale. And the other ones are blue notes, you know. You don't have that many options, you know. You listen to classical music too, you know. It's the same, you can have the same experience. Any genre of music you listen to, there's a repetitiveness to the genre because of various basic constrictions of the sort of musical world we're occupying. I mean, there's only so many notes between octaves. There's only so many chord progressions. And so what I've always found as an artist is I always have felt like my main strength is my lyric writing, although I love music and I am a fairly accomplished guitarist, but it's the lyrics that come easily for me. And the music is always like, I know when it works, but it's a lot of work and a lot of time, and it often doesn't work. It takes a while to come up with something that works. And then every couple of years, I'm throughout my career, I guess, I've been learning a new instrument or doing something along those lines, getting into a totally different style of music, sometimes with like real intentionality and other times just because that's what happens when you like music. But to the extent that it's intentional, it's because it's hard to come up with interesting new music for your lyrics. So, you know, that's why, is partly why I got into, you know, playing the electric cello 12 years ago again. And it's why I got into playing the bouzouki and the mandola. And it's why I got into punk rock 25 years ago. I'm always looking to shake things up musically. And this is just it's just part of that process using AI. And it's also not nearly as new as people think. I mean, I have been working with engineers in my albums who have been using AI assisted technologies for many years. It's just in recent years everybody knows about it, and everybody, you know, and the technology has gotten so much better. But it's been true for many years that there's been like AI platforms for, you know, if you want to record a drum track to your guitar part and your guitar part is not in perfect rhythm, you can adjust the rhythm with AI. You can make the drum part sound like the drummer is playing with you live, you know, when it's all just AI giving the AI platform a minute to figure it all out, and then they rearrange the whole song in a way that most people would never notice.
Well, and it's also more accessible now, as you mentioned, like people can do, can be their own engineers at home for, you know, affordably, where that was impossible. David, we're fast out of time. I will mention again that the tour dates are up at davidrovics.com. It's Thursday, the 25th of June is the kickoff. That's here in Victoria, Broadview United Church, a very nice venue. I don't know if you've been there before, but it's a great venue with a nice big stage. You'll be playing out at Souk on the 26th, up Island in Cumberland, on July 4th. You won't be in America for July 4th. And Sowintula Island, BC, at the Rec Center on the 7th, and Alert Bay on the 9th. That's a cool place, too, on another small island. Mm-hmm. And over in the Big Smoke, Vancouver, on the 11th of July. Thanks a lot, David, for coming on and talking a little bit about your work with us again. David Rovics, ROVICS.com. Go there. It's an immense website full of stuff of interest, as well as the poster that I'll include in the notes of this show. Good luck with the tour, David.
Thank you, Chris. Great talking to you.
And thanks to Randy Caravaggio. You'll be playing your Victoria gig, I should mention again, in aid of Cuba, and as part of all the great work you do and all the help that you bring to demos and every other, you know, progressive movement. Titan in our midst.
And Randy is the same, I would have to say. I know I didn't hear your interview with Randy, but he's an amazing organizer. And if we needed people, if we had just about 100 people like him in every city in the world, then we could totally, that would be enough to completely change the face of civilization for the better.
Yeah,
no question about it.
Yeah, 100 Randys.
Can you imagine?
No.
Can you imagine that level of organizing capability?
Not in one room, anyway. I'm just kidding, Randy.
I want to see it.
Okay, David, I'll talk to you again, and I'll see you on the 25th here in Victoria.
Wonderful.
That's all I got for this week. Till the next time.
You can look around the world and the wars are everywhere. People running for the borders trying to get out of there. As bad as it is in Savannah and the DRC, as horrific as it is in so many countries, there's only one where Western allies keep all the people inside. A concentration camp where they're committing genocide. There's only one place on the planet where no one can get out. Where what we can see happening leaves absolutely no doubt. The Holocaust is now. Can wonder all day long how this could possibly be going on right now in the 21st century. You can wonder even more how the genociders could largely be descended from genocide survivors. But that's how it is. The facts are inescapable. If your eyes are open and the facts are on the table, can you spend $200 to buy a loaf of bread? Neither can the Palestinians. They're dying instead. The Holocaust is now. Any fancy weaponry, starvation and disease kills much more quietly. The plague is upon them. The rats are eating children, sewage by the mattresses, and nowhere they can run. All the infrastructure ruined, completely decimated. Nothing left in the ghetto but the emaciated. All the bodies buried beneath what used to be the plazas and what was once a living place called Gaza. The Holocaust is now. From being bombed and starved and beaten alive. The Black Death was a tea party compared to Gaza. Now only Auschwitz can compare. If you wanna look at how they're killing off the people so systematically, using all the latest high technology, industrial slaughter like the world has not seen since the days of Hitler's genocidal regime. The Holocaust is now.
going to stop it, and how?